Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back. And as I said earlier, we are dispensing with the usual format of the show today, and we will be for the next couple of shows as well, as we are not having two guests with me on the programme today, just one guest. And that's because I really thought it would be worth getting the very best out of the guests we're having on in this series, which I've labelled US Masters of Apologetics. And today we're very privileged to welcome William Lane Craig. William is a research professor, philosophy at Talbot School of Theology, and his book Reasonable Faith is in its third edition now and is generally considered to be a core book for anyone interested in defence of the Christian faith. And Bill, as he's often referred to as his friends, is a worldwide lecturer, speaker, writer, and very much at the forefront of Christian apologetics. Bill, thank you so much for joining me on the programme today.
Good to be with you, Justin.
It's a great privilege because I've long wanted to have you on this program. This program exists in many ways to help Christians with their grappling with the faith, especially in the area of apologetics. And we do that usually in the format of a discussion. But I've long, you know, everyone I've ever come into contact with has who's, you know, known their apologetics has said, "Have you ever had Bill Craig on?" And up to this point, I haven't been able to say yes, but now I can say yes.
Good.
So tell me a bit, though, Bill, in your own life, when did things start for you? When did God become a reality in your journey?
Well, that's a good question. I've always believed in God from the tiniest childhood. I've sensed that there has to be a creator, an explanation of the universe. But at the same time, God was not a reality to me in my life. That did not happen until much later during my teenage years when I began to ask what I call the big questions in life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? What's the meaning of my existence? And in the search for answers, I began to attend a local church in our community. My family was not a church-going family or a Christian family, though it was a good, loving home. And as I attended this church, I was deeply bothered by the hypocrisy that I saw there. The other high school students who claimed to be such good Christians on Sunday lived for their real God the rest of the week, which was popularity. And this bothered me greatly because I thought, here I feel so spiritually empty inside, and yet externally, at least, I'm leading a better life than they are, and they claim to be Christians. They must just all be a pack of hypocrites, phonies, pretending to be something they're really not. And so I began to grow very alienated and bitter toward people in the institutional church and toward people in general. Everybody I thought is a hypocrite and a fake, and the real person is cowering down inside, afraid to come out and be real. And so I was on my way, frankly, toward becoming a very alienated young man. And that was when I met a girl in my high school German class who sat in front of me, who was a radiant Christian and who shared her faith with me and shared with me God's love. And no one had ever told me this before. No one had ever said to me that God loves me. And that thought just staggered me, to think that the God of the universe, who created these infinite worlds, compared to which I was but an infinitesimal speck, that this God could love me. And so I began to read for the first time the New Testament and just devoured it from cover to cover. And as I read about the life and the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, there was a ring of truth about this man's teaching that I'd never encountered before, and there was an authenticity about his life that wasn't characteristic of these people in the local church that I was attending that claimed to be his followers. And I realized then I couldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, this period of intense spiritual searching went on for about 6 months until I just finally came to the end of my rope and just cried out to God to save me. And I experienced a tremendous spiritual rebirth, an inner transformation, just an inflooding of the Spirit of God and of joy and a tremendous peace that changed my life. And so it was in that moment that God became a reality to me. I had always believed that there was a creator of the universe, but he wasn't real to me until that moment that I gave my life to Christ and experienced this spiritual rebirth. The light really came on at that point.
It's a fantastic story, but did the disconnect that you saw between the way that so-called Christians around you acted and the person you saw in Jesus Christ, I mean, did that still bother you? Did you find a way of getting through
I did, because what I understood was that these persons were merely nominal Christians, that they weren't, in fact, persons who were followers of Christ in the way that Christ explained his followers should look. And so it was very evident to me that there was a difference between someone who is nominally Christian and someone who has actually experienced this inner transformational power of the Holy Spirit. And this gal that introduced me to Christ in high school was really, I think, the first authentic Christian I had ever met. And she introduced me then to other Christians in the high school. And I had never met people like this. I didn't know people like this existed. People who claimed, at least, to have a genuine relationship with God and who seemed to be in contact with a different plane of reality than I was, a reality that imparted a deep meaning and joy and peace to their lives. And so after becoming a Christian, although I continued to attend this local church for some months in the effort to share with my classmates what had happened to me, eventually I found that I wasn't being spiritually fed there, and I needed to go to a church that really did proclaim faithfully the gospel of Christ, a church where I could be a part of a body of Christians who had also experienced this inner transformation of God's Spirit and who were seeking to live as genuine disciples of Christ. And so that was eventually what happened.
Well, obviously, there was a very experiential element to your transformation.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, your career has been very much about the logical, reasonable, if you like, side, objectively, the arguments that exist for God and for faith in Jesus Christ. So presumably you see it as a balance of the two.
I do, very much so. Being from a non-Christian family and having no Christian acquaintances as a high school student, I was immediately involved in trying to share with my family and friends why I had become a Christian and what this transformation was that had taken place in my life. And so I was just immediately plunged into the task of giving reasons for why I thought that this was true. And so that element, I think, came along almost immediately in virtue of the fact that I was in a non-Christian culture and family. And that became accentuated as I went to college and began to develop a Christian world and life view in which I wanted to be able to share with people that this step was the step of faith, was not something that simply met the needs of your heart, but also met the needs of your head. And the balance that I eventually achieved between these experiential and rational facets of faith comes to expression in the distinction that I've drawn between knowing my faith to be true and showing my faith to be true. Mm. I still maintain that the fundamental way in which I know that Christianity is true is on the basis of the immediate encounter with God himself, that the witness of the Holy Spirit in the heart of a person who has been transformed by him is a self-authenticating experience that gives him an immediate knowledge that Christianity is true. But that when we come to sharing that with someone else and showing them that it's true, we're involved in the task of giving arguments and evidence to show that what we know to be true is in fact true. And so that's the balance that I try to achieve between knowing and showing my faith to be true.
And it's interesting, before we move on, that you obviously feel that the fact that you were in, if you like, that non-Christian environment growing up and that you had to explain to people your faith was part of the reason that you adopted, if you like, that reason for having to be that kind of a person. And that you share that in common, I suppose, with other, you know, I can think of many Christian expositors, leading Christian thinkers who have actually come from an atheist background. And it's because of that that they've really had to nurture those skills.
I think so, because immediately people will say to you, well, Bill, you've just had an emotional experience. And since they've never experienced this inner rebirth and don't know what it is, you've got to say, well, no, this isn't just an emotional experience. There are good reasons to believe that this is a veridical experience, that is to say, an experience of some genuine reality. And so you're plunged immediately into the task of Christian apologetics.
Well, it's that's what we're going to be looking at in the rest of the show this afternoon. And if you're listening and you're wondering, who is this American gentleman that I've got with me on the show today? His name is William Lane Craig. And to anyone who has any real engagement with Christian apologetics, the defense of the faith, his name really comes near the top of the pile as far as his influence on the scene today. Bill is the author of many books, a lecturer. He tours the world, really, debating others as well. His book, Reasonable Faith, is now in its third edition, and we're going to be looking at some of the aspects of that book and what Bill is trying to show about God and why we have very strong arguments, particularly for the existence of God. We're going to be looking at that in some depth as we continue discussing these things with Bill. So do stay tuned here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Justin Brierley with you through till 4 o'clock this afternoon.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. It's my pleasure to have on the programme with me today William Lane Craig, who is the author of many books on Christian apologetics. He is a research professor of philosophy at Talbot School of Theology in the USA, and he is the second in line in our current series on US Masters of Apologetics. Last week we heard from Gary Habermas. This week William Lane Craig joins us on the programme. We're particularly looking at his book Reasonable Faith, now in its third edition. It is a staple kind of part of the diet for anyone interested in Christian apologetics, defending the Christian faith. You can actually find a copy of that if you'd like to know more on the Premier Shop webpage. That's premier.org.uk/shop. Just if it's not on the front page already, you can just type in a search for William Lane Craig and it'll bring it up for you. So, William, am I okay to call you Bill, by the way? Because I've just kind of, I've fallen into that kind of automatically, and I hope you don't mind my, you know.
Not at all.
Well, Bill, in that case, a lot of what you've been doing over the years has been arguing for the existence of God. Now, there are different ways that different people will do that. And I know that some will maybe start with Jesus Christ and his death and resurrection as being a kind of a proof. But there are other ways as well of trying to, if you like, in a more general way, prove God. And this is something that I know you do tackle in the book Reasonable Faith, because as far as you're concerned, there are some pretty strong arguments out there, philosophical arguments, that is,
yes,
for the existence of God.
Yes, I think that's right.
What would you say, if you like, would be the first argument you might turn to if you were trying to explain to someone why you think there is good philosophical reason for believing in God?
Well, I think one of the most fundamental arguments will be the argument from contingency, as it's sometimes called. And this is basically an attempt to answer the question, why does anything at all exist? It's very puzzling that anything should exist, especially since everything that we see around us seems to be contingent in its being. That is to say, it doesn't have to exist. So if all of these things don't have to exist, we wonder, well, then why does anything at all exist? And it would seem that we have to get back to some sort of a necessary being whose non-existence is impossible and which is the explanation for why everything else contingent exists. And that argument or that intuition can be developed into the form of an argument with, I think, very plausible premises that lead to the conclusion that God exists.
It's sometimes referred to as the Kalam argument. I don't know where it gets the title exactly.
Well, that's a different argument, actually, than the one I just gave.
Okay.
The one that I just gave, the contingency argument, would be a form of the cosmological argument that was developed by the 18th century polymath Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz, the German philosopher and mathematician. Leibniz said the most fundamental question that needs to be asked is, why is there something rather than nothing?
Mm.
And he ultimately came to the conclusion that there must be a necessary, metaphysically necessary being whom he called God, which is the explanation or the sufficient reason why anything at all exists. And that's different from the other argument that you mentioned.
I mean, an atheist might say, and something that Richard Dawkins is very keen to point out in his bestseller, The God Delusion, that, you know, well, if you say everything must have a cause, you know, where did the universe come from, then, and you say it was God, well, that's not a very good explanation, because then you have to ask, well, who created God then, you know?
Right, and that's why it's important to understand that by an explanation, Leibniz did not mean a cause. When he says that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, he doesn't mean that it has a cause of its existence. In the case of a necessary being, the explanation for why it exists is simply that it exists by a necessity of its own nature. Now, an example would be, say, mathematical objects. Many mathematicians believe that things like numbers and sets and functions and other mathematical objects exist necessarily. There aren't any causes of these things. They just exist by a necessity of their own nature. So if you were to ask, why are there numbers, the answer would be they exist by a necessity of their own nature. By contrast, things that do not exist by a necessity of their own nature have external causes. So what, and that would be, for example, people and galaxies and birds and trees and so forth. These don't exist by a necessity of their own nature, and therefore they have external causes. So the argument would be that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or else in some external cause. And with respect to God, he would exist by a necessity of his own nature, not by some external cause. He exists necessarily. The ultimate explanation will be a metaphysically necessary being whose non-existence is impossible.
But what about those who would say, you know, hang about, why do we have to have the universe have sprung out of something? Couldn't we say it's always been around? You know,
yes, you could, and that was why I said this argument is different from the Kalam cosmological argument. Leibniz's argument does not assume that the universe had a beginning or sprang into being. It's perfectly consistent with the idea that the universe is eternal and always been there. Leibniz gives the analogy of geometry books. He says, suppose you ask why a certain geometry book exists. And the answer is, well, it was copied from a prior book. And if you say, well, where did that book come from? Why does it exist? Well, it was copied from a prior book. And he says, this could go back to infinity, and we would still wonder, well, then why does this infinite series of geometry books copied from one another exist? Why do these geometry books exist rather than nothing? The question isn't resolved simply by saying there were earlier states. So if the universe has existed from infinity past eternally, we can still ask, well, why is there an eternal universe existing instead of just nothing?
The interesting thing, of course, is that in the last 100 years or so, science has actually given us a very interesting alternative to that hypothesis of a never-ending universe. It's actually come up with this idea that there was a very specific beginning to the universe, and that, in a sense, has changed the ground quite a bit, hasn't it?
I think so, and this would impact Leibniz's argument in the following way. One of the characteristics of a metaphysically necessary being is that it must be eternal. If something comes into existence, then that shows that it doesn't exist necessarily, because it has come into being. It's possible for it not to exist. So if the atheist would be tempted to answer Leibniz's argument by saying, well, Maybe the universe exists by a necessity of its own nature. Maybe the universe is a necessarily existing being. This fact that the universe began to exist undermines that because it shows that the universe is not necessary in its existence. On the contrary, it's radically contingent. It came into being and therefore cannot be the ultimate explanation of why something exists rather than nothing. So this discovery of the beginning of the universe, I think, reinforces Leibniz's argument that the metaphysically necessary being cannot be the universe itself. It must be a transcendent being beyond the universe, beyond space and time, which is responsible for the universe's existence.
When you really delve into these are quite complex philosophical issues at work here, and in a sense we're only grazing the top of the subject. But
right.
But when you're in debates with other philosophers, atheist philosophers, for you this probably seems like an absolutely obvious fact. But what is it that is stopping them from accepting that there must have been a cause, and a cause that didn't have a cause?
A cause of the universe, but we're looking for an explanation. Remember, I said that an explanation doesn't need to be a cause.
Yes.
But here's the traditional response to Leibniz. The traditional response is it is just false that everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. These philosophers would just say that the universe is just a brute fact, that it has no explanation. This was what Bertrand Russell said in his famous BBC radio debate with Frederick Copleston. He said, the universe is just there, and that's all. And so he simply refused to go down the path of seeking an explanation for the universe. And so you have to ask yourself, which do you think is more plausible, that everything that exists has an explanation for its existence, or that things can exist inexplicably, that contingent things can just exist with no explanation at all? I find the premise of Leibniz's argument to be much more plausible than the contradictory of it.
Now, moving on from this to another important argument, and I think, again, this is one that ties in very much with science and what scientists have been able to show us about the amazing aspects of the universe around us, something that, to give it its long-winded title, we might call the teleological argument, in another form, the argument from fine-tuning. It appears, many scientists are suggesting these days, that the universe can only exist in a way that allows life to have been produced because of some extremely finely tuned constants that exist and were there, that were present at the moment of the Big Bang, and that this is an evidence, perhaps, of a creator God who intended this universe to be fashioned in the way that it is.
That's right. The discovery by scientists within the last 40 years or so that the initial conditions of the Big Bang were fine-tuned with an incomprehensible delicacy for the existence of intelligent life has prompted an enormous debate among scientists and philosophers of science over what is the best explanation of this extraordinary fine-tuning. And not a few are quite willing to say that the best explanation is that the universe is the product of a transcendent designer who fine-tuned the universe so that intelligent life could exist.
It's interesting. I mean, I was just speaking with Gary Habermas last week about the interesting case of an atheist philosopher who changed his stripes, as it were, Anthony Flew, and the fact that he has in recent years come out to say that actually he does believe that arguments such as the fine-tuning of the universe suggest that in fact there is a creator God rather than there not being one. And do you feel like, I don't know, that there's maybe a resurgence in belief these days in God, that things are maybe moving away from, I guess, a very atheistic kind of philosophical outlook that perhaps existed in around the middle of the 20th century?
I couldn't say on the popular level, but certainly in the field of Anglo-American philosophy, there has been a tremendous resurgence of theistic philosophy, and specifically Christian philosophy. so that today some of the most prominent philosophers at England and America's most prestigious universities are outspoken Bible-believing Christians. I've laid out an account of this in the current issue of Christianity Today. The cover story of that magazine for July is called God is Not Dead Yet, and it describes the movement among contemporary philosophers in the Anglophone world to revive all of the traditional arguments for God's existence. So that would be something perhaps your listeners might be interested in looking at.
Absolutely. You can find that article actually online. I was able to access it before I came on air today. And if you go to the Christianity Today website, that's the American magazine Christianity Today, Bill's cover issue, sort of cover story, is certainly a good indication of where the things stand at the moment. You, as I say, do a lot of travelling, Bill. You get to meet a lot of people. I know that on this programme I invite atheists and people of other faiths to debate with Christians, and that's something you've done a lot of yourself over the years. What do you feel is the value in having those kind of debates with people who have a different point of view to yourself?
I think there's a couple of values. One is that a debate will draw a crowd like nothing else will. Students today are very suspicious of hearing just one side of the story. They like to hear they like to have a level playing field in which proponents of both sides have an equal say and equal time. And so the debate format appeals naturally to that instinct for fair play in students today. And so whereas maybe a few hundred might come out and hear me give a lecture at a university, we will have several hundred or even thousands of students come out to hear a debate. So, for example, when I was in Great Britain a year ago, March, we had over 2,000 people pack out Central Hall in Westminster in central London to hear my debate with Lewis Wolpert on Is God a Delusion? We had 1,100 people fill the Great Hall at Bristol University to hear the debate there. I think we had around 800 to 900 at University of Liverpool for the debate that I had with Mike Bagan there on Is God a Delusion? Each place that we had debates in Great Britain at British universities, the auditoriums were packed with students. So that would be the first value, I think, is that it really is something that will attract an audience where they can hear a defense of the gospel of Christianity. The second thing is that I think that it shatters the stereotypes of Christians as ignorant, Bible-pounding emotionalists who have no intellectual wherewithal to defend or explain their beliefs. I love to just shatter the caricatures that people have of Christians as being backward and anti-intellectual and so forth. And it's a very sobering experience for them to see a Christian go up against one of the top secular scholars at their university and come out on top with better arguments and better explanations. And I hope that will begin to produce some cracks in the facade of resistance that they put up to Christianity and make them think a second time, maybe this really could be true. Maybe I'd better check it out.
Just as a matter of interest, you know, you've obviously been over to the UK a few times at least in your career. And as you say, last year you drew a number of crowds. What was your feeling of the temperature, if you like, the spiritual temperature in the UK? Did you find the students you were speaking with more receptive, less receptive than you might find in the US?
Well, it's hard to gauge that from a public forum. But I would say that what I sensed was just tremendous interest. Whether or not there was receptivity, I'm not sure, but there was certainly tremendous interest. It was not at all apathetic or indifferent. People wanted to hear about these issues. They wanted to grapple with them. They wanted to wrestle personally with these. So I can say that, I think, with confidence, that there was tremendous interest in the at the universities at which I spoke. And that was quite a surprise, by the way, to some of the moderators, like John Humphreys, who moderated the debate in Central Hall. He said, as I look out at this sea of young faces, he says, whether you believe in God or not, he said, you've got to admit something is happening here. This is just extraordinary. He just couldn't believe the crowd.
Yeah, and that's a testament, as you say, to the interest people have. When people are searching, aren't they? And at the moment, the fact is that Richard Dawkins seems to have the lion's share in terms of people's attention. He's written a very popular book, though having said that, I know most theologians and philosophers worth their salt don't give it much credence. But nonetheless, he is a very popular speaker. He has put his points across very well. However, you may feel that they're flawed.
And yet, as you say, Dawkins has helped to stir the pot to make this debate interesting. I think that's why we titled the debates that I participated in, Is God a Delusion? It was obviously piggybacking on his book. And by stirring the pot and attacking belief in God, he makes people all the more interested in the truth of the question.
Just before we have to leave this section of the show, a third argument for the existence of God, the moral argument, that again is developed in your book, Reasonable Faith. Tell us in simple terms what that involves.
All right. When I was speaking on university campuses years ago, I would give a talk called The Absurdity of Life Without God. And what I argued was that if there is no God, if atheism is true, then our end is simply the grave. All of mankind, the whole human race, is doomed to destruction in the heat death of the universe, and that in light of this fact, life becomes absurd. There is no meaning, value, or purpose to life.
What's the point, one could say?
Yes, that's right. Now, certainly we could have subjective, personal values and projects and things of that sort, but there wouldn't be any objective meaning, value, or purpose in life. Well, what I found students often responding to this by saying, but surely there are some things that are objectively right and wrong. Love is objectively good. Cruelty is objectively evil. Surely there are objective moral values, for example. Now, what they were saying didn't refute anything that I said. What it did was it supplied a missing premise in a moral argument for God's existence. And what I realized was that they had actually given me an argument for God. It would go like this. If God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. That is to say, on atheism or naturalism, everything becomes relative. There are no objective moral values.
On a naturalistic view of the universe, there is nothing beyond the matter that we exist of. There's nothing beyond,
It's just everything
that
is just, as Richard Dawkins puts it so colorfully, he says there is no good, no evil, no purpose, just pointless indifference. We are machines for propagating DNA. It is every object's sole reason for being. I think he's right on naturalism. If God doesn't exist, there are no objective moral values, just subjective personal opinions. But then the second premise is that objective moral values do exist. And this was the premise supplied by the students in response to me. It's clear, I think, that there are certain things that are objectively wrong and right. And Dawkins' own book is filled with examples: intolerance, religious bigotry, hatred, persecution, discrimination. All of these things he denounces as objectively evil and wrong. But from those two premises, it follows logically and inescapably that therefore God exists.
So, but couldn't someone say, well, look, yes, I can talk about love being good and cruelty being wrong. It does seem obvious to anybody that, torturing innocent babies is absolutely wrong. But why do we have to say God put the rule in place? Can't we just say that's something that we know as humans, that is obvious to us? Do we have to sort of posit some kind of divine lawmaker who made it so?
Well, if the first premise is true, you do, because the first premise says if God does not exist, objective moral values do not exist. We are, as you say, just various complex configurations of matter. We're just basically relatively advanced primates. We're animals, and animals are not moral agents. When a lion kills a zebra, it kills the zebra, but it doesn't murder the zebra. When a hawk seizes a fish from the talons of another hawk, it takes the fish, but it doesn't steal the fish, because none of these things have any moral dimension to them. They're neither prohibited nor obligatory. And on atheism, that's all we are, is just animals, relatively advanced primates, and there's no reason to think that our subjective perceptions of moral value are objectively true.
I mean, I can imagine Richard Dawkins might come back with some explanation for you and say, yes, I know it looks like these things are objectively true because we feel them so deeply, but it's actually just about our evolution,
right.
That the evolution of society has made it, contingent, necessary for us to hold certain values so that we can progress as a species, that sort of thing.
Now, see, you're agreeing with the first premise and denying the second premise that you affirmed before. And I find this so often with people that I talk to about the moral argument. When you give the defense of one premise, they deny the other premise. When you give the defense of the other premise, then they jump back and deny the first premise. And so they jump back and forth, not knowing where to land. I agree with Dawkins that if God does not exist, then he's absolutely right. Moral values are just the socio-culturally relative byproducts of biological and social evolution. That's right, if there is no God. But that doesn't mean that is all they are. If God exists, then moral values are objective.
So does this argument, in terms of it helping to point people to God, mm-hmm. does it depend on that person believing that there is objective truth? So it's kind of like you have to have that assumption because it's somehow so...
Well, I wouldn't say so much it's an assumption as that it's something that's given to us in our moral experience. I would simply invite a person to reflect on his moral experience and say, do you really believe that raping a little child is a morally indifferent act, equivalent on the same moral plane as nurturing and loving that child? And almost everybody recognizes, when you talk to them, if they're honest with you, that these are not morally indifferent acts.
It's like
slavery and genocide and the Holocaust and so forth are genuinely, objectively evil.
It's a very powerful argument, and one that obviously you develop in greater detail in the book. We're talking this afternoon with Bill Lane Craig. He is a well-known name in Christian apologetics, and his book Reasonable Faith, now in its third edition, covers many of these core ideas about these philosophical arguments for the existence of God. If you want to find out more, do visit the website of Bill, reasonablefaith.org, and do check out the Premier shop if you'd like to purchase a copy of Reasonable Faith. It's available there, premier.org.uk/shop. Bill, I hope you can stay with us a little longer. I'd love to continue chatting to you, and we'll be back in just a short moment here on Unbelievable. Welcome back to the programme. Continuing with William Lane Craig shortly. Let me tell you, though, that next week we're going to be hearing from another philosopher. And it's going to be quite an in-depth discussion next week as we're joined by Alvin Plantinga. Now, Alvin is, again, a leading Christian philosopher in the world today as we continue this series of American Masters of Apologetics. And he is probably best known for his free will defense of the problem of evil. This is a problem that's existed for millennia. How can an all-powerful, loving God allow the evil that we see exists in our world? Well, Alvin has devoted much of his life to finding philosophical answers to that. We'll be hearing what he has to say, and it's a real chance to learn from another master of apologetics. Do join me for that at the same time between 2:30 and 4 o'clock next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
And we're continuing in conversation with Bill Lane Craig. This is a unique opportunity. If you're a regular listener to the programme, you'll know that normally we have a Christian and a non-Christian in the studio. Well, we're dropping that format just for a few weeks as we concentrate on what I'm calling some of the US masters of apologetics. And Bill has that, I think he's certainly worthy of that title, because he really is considered one of the top minds when it comes to the defence of the Christian gospel. Bill, you were describing some of the debates you've had on university campuses, etc. And to my mind, I think that really is a very formative time in any person's life. And in a sense, it's with good reason, I suppose, that it's those kind of places that you choose to go and talk and speak and to debate.
Yes, particularly because this was about the same age that my life was so transformed by coming to know God personally through Jesus Christ. And so I have a predisposition to try to share this truth with students who were about the same age that I was when my life was so transformed.
Interestingly, it's not just atheists that you debate with, but people of other faiths as well. For instance, I've watched a very interesting discussion you had with a Muslim on the resurrection of Jesus. And I suppose in that instance, you're calling on different kinds of arguments, because there is a shared belief in God,
yes,
but obviously there's very different views about Jesus Christ.
Right. I think that's where one wants to focus in talking with a Muslim, is who was Jesus of Nazareth, because he is the stumbling stone that both Muslims and Jews, I think, cannot get over in terms of his radical personal claims and his resurrection from the dead.
The resurrection is often sort of focused on by many philosophers, Christian philosophers, as being a key claim, if you like, of Christianity. Is that a kind of a point from which you would start if you were perhaps trying to convince someone who maybe had a general belief in God but wasn't sure about whether Christianity was true in its claims?
Yes, I would. This would be my focal point, and I think it was the focal point of the earliest apostles when they preached the gospel and would reach out to not only Jewish but also Gentile audiences. They would say that God has made this truth evident by appointing a man by whom he will judge the world, and he has proven this by raising him from the dead. So the resurrection of Jesus is really the central miracle of the New Testament in vindicating the identity of Jesus of Nazareth.
I mean, many people will say that happened 2,000 years ago, and you're trying to kind of convince me of a massive truth on the evidence of, a book that was written all that time ago. I mean, on the face of it, that seems like a bold thing to be able to claim to do. I mean, most people don't believe what they read in the papers that were only published this morning. I mean, why should they believe something that is 2,000 years old and could have been...
Well, it is astonishing. I mean, you would think that an event like the resurrection, even if it occurred, would hardly leave much trace so as to be able to provide evidence for it. And yet, I did my doctoral work in this area in Germany, and I was quite astonished to find what I think are very good grounds historically for believing in the historicity of this event. And the fact that it happened 2,000 years ago, Justin, I think it's important to understand, is really irrelevant. The crucial gap is not between the time of the event and today. Rather, the crucial gap is between the time of the event and the evidence for that event. If the gap between the event and the evidence for that event is relatively narrow, then the fact that the event and the evidence for it have receded into the past doesn't do anything to undermine that evidence. Good evidence doesn't become bad evidence just because of the passage of time. So how far it is from the evidence to today is really quite irrelevant. What's crucial was the evidence close to the event that it describes? And in this case, it was. We have records of the life of Jesus that were written within the first generation after his death while the eyewitnesses were still alive. And these sources depended upon even earlier sources that go back even closer to the events that are described, so that I think we have very trustworthy documents recording the life and claims of Jesus of Nazareth.
I won't pursue that too much further, because we covered a lot of ground with Gary Habermas last week on this very subject, and had a fascinating time with him. But it does interest me that obviously your message, you know, is to different types of audience, and so you will adopt an approach that is pragmatic and appropriate to that particular audience. And obviously you're talking to Christians as well, who maybe share a lot of beliefs. But
true, though my focus is on the non-believer, my heart is really to try to share with non-believers the wonderful truth of what God has done in the gospel, because it has so changed my life that I want them to find the joy and the wonder of knowing God in this way as well. And so my focus is really on trying to convince the non-Christian.
I mean, on that level, I can imagine that perhaps a lot of your debate opponents may not go away convinced, but I guess it's more the effect that you're having perhaps on those who are watching the debate that counts.
Absolutely. The point of the debate, Justin, is not to try to persuade my opponent. I think people sometimes misunderstand that. Anybody who's willing to get up in front of an audience of hundreds or thousands of people and denounce Christianity and reject God and Christ isn't going to be persuaded in the space of an hour to believe. Rather, my goal is to persuade the people in the audience who are still open and searching, whose hearts are open to the truth but are agnostic or uncertain. Those are the people that I'm trying to reach.
Do you hear stories of people who have gone all the way to making a decision for Jesus Christ because of perhaps something that was sparked through hearing a lecture or a debate that you've given?
Oh, yeah, I get these reports all the time, and not only in response to lectures or debates, but also to things that I've written or a DVD that they've seen somewhere. And very often these will be people in Muslim countries or communist countries where I would never have the opportunity to speak with them personally, and yet they've come into contact with a recording or a book that has helped them to come to Christ, and then sometimes this will get communicated to me via the internet, and it's always thrilling to hear stories like that.
Absolutely, very encouraging, because as you say, that is the ultimate aim. It's not, I guess, about intellectual point scoring. There's a much bigger goal here.
Right. I'm not interested in just winning arguments. I want to win people.
Going back to the book, I mean, beyond the arguments for God, you talk about the development, if you like, of Christian thought. The age we're living in now, do you think people kind of, we've reached a zenith of understanding our faith, of understanding the reasons for our faith? Are we at the, you know, are we have a superior position to any Christians who have gone before on that level?
Well, that's a good question. I do think that we are extremely well positioned. One reason, for example, would be that prior to the Renaissance, Christians or scholars in general didn't really have the historical method. They did not know how to study history. Historiography was born in the Renaissance. And so as a result, biblical studies have advanced, I think, to what you would call a zenith. Today, it is more advanced than any time it's been since the first century, when people could still ask the eyewitnesses. So that, and again, this ties into the question that you asked before, far from the passage of time making the evidence less certain, I feel like we have more certain access to the historical facts about the first century and about Jesus of Nazareth because the science of historiography has become so developed. Similarly, the advances in modern science that have disclosed to us the beginning of the universe and the fine-tuning of the universe have made physicists more open to the existence of God than at any time in recent memory. And philosophically, we're experiencing a renaissance in Christian philosophy, as I said. So while I by no means think that we are at a high point that cannot be surpassed, I think the next generation will continue to advance. nevertheless, I think we are living at a time in history at which we have really extraordinarily good reasons for faith and are extremely well positioned compared to the people who lived at other times and places in human history.
Which leads me to ask, given that we've, if you like, got the best arguments we've ever had really at our disposal, why is it that Christian belief is waning in the world around us, at least here in the West?
It's good that you qualified that because it's not waning. I mean, Christianity is exploding throughout the world today, in Latin America, in Africa, in Asia, particularly in China. Christianity is growing at unprecedented rates, never before seen. Patrick Johnstone, who is the author of a missions handbook called Operation World, which gives the demographics of various countries in the world and the advance of Christianity around the world, says that we are living at a time of the greatest ingathering of people into the kingdom of God that has ever been seen in human history. It is only in the West that the growth rates are flat, in Western Europe and to a degree in North America. But in the rest of the world, Christianity is growing at unprecedented rates. And evangelical Christianity in particular is growing faster than any religion in the world.
It's encouraging on that level when you do look at the bigger picture.
I'm tremendously encouraged. You know, I think that the pessimistic attitude that many Western Christians have is simply due to a sort of myopia where they only see what's happening in their immediate environment and they fail to raise their eyes to the broader horizon to see what God is doing in the world today. We are living at one of the most exciting periods of human history, and it's my prayer that even in the West, this situation is not irreversible. I think that in the West, it's very possible through, for example, this renaissance of Christian philosophy that's going on, that this is going to have a trickle-down effect to the man in the street, and that we may well see a resurgence of evangelical Christianity take place in the West as well.
That means churches really taking this stuff on board, though, doesn't it? I mean, do you think maybe we've been too long, if you like, ignoring or not using these resources, that we've maybe made our Christianity too, if you like, on the emotional side, although that's important, we've made it too subjective. We've said, you know, we haven't presented the evidence that does exist.
Right. It's not through an overemphasis on the emotional or affective side of the Christian faith. It's due to an underemphasis on the rational or intellective side of the Christian faith. Both sides need to be emphasized and work together like a hand in a glove.
I would say as well, and this may be a slightly controversial thing to say, but in my experience running a show like this, where we are doing this a lot, putting the intellectual arguments, I get a lot of men listen and respond. And there's something I think that is certainly engages the male brain very much when they have an argument to look at, and that maybe explains why in the UK churches, for instance, it's 2/3 female and 1/3 male.
Oh boy, Justin, I mean, I think you're putting your finger on something that is very important here. Our worship experiences in church have become so effeminate that the praise songs that are often sung are like popular love songs, romantic songs that you just substitute God or Jesus in for the name of your lover. You know, they're very romantic, feminized sorts of things. And I think that we need to appeal to the intellect and to the reason if we're not to lose the men. And I find in my own class that I teach at our church, I have an adult class called Defenders, where I teach Christian doctrine and apologetics. It is the men, especially, who are drawn to this class and want to come. And we have many women in the class as well who have told us privately, I don't understand everything in this class, but I come because this is the only spiritual activity that my husband will participate in with me. And so I'm glad to be here because he wants to come and I can do it with him.
It's a very interesting thing. On the subject of Christians and your engagement with Christians, I mean, at least part of your ministry, I suppose, is aimed at helping Christians when they go through those periods of doubt. Because
yes, or to prevent them by equipping them in advance.
Exactly.
Commend their faith rationally.
And I think that's, I think, where why a lot of obviously Christians would want to buy your book, not just so that they can it can help them to present the gospel to their mm-hmm. people around them, but because it will help them in their own journey. Because I think we all at some point experience some kind of doubt about faith.
Of course.
I mean, does that happen to you? Is that something you've experienced in your life?
Of course. I mean, in fact, all the time. I mean, I'm constantly reading atheistic literature and attacks upon Christianity and so forth. I mean, this is something that I do all the time. And so, of course, one wonders, could I be deluded? Could they be right? Are these arguments really sound? And so I think anybody who holds to a position, who holds to a truth claim, is going to ask himself periodically, am I right? Do I have adequate reasons for this? And so we'll ask those kinds of questions. So I think the goal of the Christian life is not to have no doubts. Rather, the goal of the Christian life is to learn how to live with unanswered questions without allowing them to become destructive doubts.
And I suppose it's also about not losing the fact that we do have more than just our intellectual beliefs in Christianity. We have a subjective experience of Christianity, and perhaps it's when people start to doubt that as well that the doubts really start to overtake.
Well, we come full circle now to where we began the interview with the self-authenticating witness of the Holy Spirit. Doubt, I think, is never simply or purely an intellectual problem, because if there is an objective witness of the Holy Spirit, if he really does indwell us and testify to us that Christianity is true and so forth, then it is only by quenching or grieving the Holy Spirit that one would allow these unanswered questions to become destructive doubts and to spoil one's walk with God and one, the vitality of one's Christian life.
It's something that I, having read a small portion of Hard Questions, Real Answers, you do deal with, that Christians really need to get a grip on not so much doubting their faith, as though doubt is a good thing in some way, rather that to accept that doubt happens, but to still be aware that their faith is going to be challenged, and they can deal with that. There are answers that they don't have to kind of succumb to the doubts that are around them.
It's what we've been talking about. It's the balance. On the one hand, we need to attend very carefully to our spiritual formation, to our devotional life, to our worship life, to our prayer life, to our sharing Christ with others, to unconfessed sin in our lives. We need to be sure that we've confessed sin, that we're clean, and to ask the Holy Spirit to fill us and guide us day by day. There's that element. But then there's also the intellective dimension, where we need to pursue questions until we come up with satisfactory answers that will answer those questions whenever we have the opportunity to.
I mean, doing this show, I've been in that position of, as you, reading through atheistic literature, you know, logging onto atheistic websites in the search often of guests, actually, for the program. But the thing that I often, if you like, gives me the most cause for concern is when I read, you know, if you like, reverse testimonies from Christians who have become atheists. And I think, you know, that person presumably had a belief, you know, they believed that they were in some kind of communion with God. And I'm not, you know, they will often say, you know, I believed in everything you believe as a Christian, but now I've realized it was all a con. It was all, you know, I'd imagined it all. I mean, it's very hard in some ways to deal with that, because it does kind of shake your faith. You do ask those questions, you know.
Yeah, I think that those reverse testimonies are very powerful, and they naturally make you wonder, well, gosh, maybe I'm like that person. Maybe I'm just deluded or something, as he thinks he was. But I would say a couple of cautionary things about that. Remember that these testimonies are deliberately crafted to elicit that reaction from you, and that many of these folks, when you get to know them better or honest, you discover that the reasons that they left faith were not really intellectual at all. They were emotional reasons having to do with a negative experience in church or with Christians, and that's why they've abandoned faith. But to make it look credible, they will emphasize the intellectual aspects of it. You see what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean, and I'm reminded of a show I did not too long ago with someone who may be familiar to you, John Loftus.
Oh, exactly.
And I was very interested reading his website and his book, etc. He's, you know, lots and lots of arguments for why he left Christianity, logical arguments. But it, what emerged in talking to him, and we had with us Peter May as our Christian interrogator, if you like, was that there was actually a very personal experience of feeling disillusioned in a church context that actually sparked the whole thing.
Yes, I think that the merit of John Loftus' reverse testimony is that he's candid about his own adultery and pornography and the way in which he felt burned and abandoned by the local church when he fell into sin, that it was really these things that prompted him to leave the faith, not the intellectual problems. And yet, you see, it's more socially acceptable to leave for intellectual reasons. This feeds your ego, it feeds your pride, because now you were too smart, you see, to continue in this delusion. And so your reverse testimony gets recast, you know, in these intellective terms. And frankly, sometimes I've heard Christians, you know, do the same thing. They came to Christ for personal or emotional reasons, but it's more credible if you present yourself as having gone through a long intellectual search and explored the evidence. You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So you've got to be really careful about these things, because I think sometimes they're not always the whole truth.
Absolutely. We often get the edited version, as it were.
And that's why in my sharing my own experience, I do not tell people, oh, I went through this period of great intellectual search and everything like that, because it's just not true. I mean, that wasn't my experience, and I want to be candid about that.
But I think it's probably true, and it's certainly true in my case as well, Bill, that people often will come into Christianity through an experience. It might be through some emotional crisis that leads them to God. But then once that initial experience, if you like, has happened, then we need more things to help us on the journey, because we need those foundational things that actually give us support to our faith.
Absolutely.
It's been fantastic talking with you, Bill. So good of you to spend over an hour of your time with us.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
I've really enjoyed our discussion, and I'm sure there are many things that people listening will perhaps want to consider again. So if you are listening and there are parts of the program you weren't able to listen to or you'd like to consider again, and don't forget, our webpage will have this interview on it very shortly. And that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Again, that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And a reminder that Bill's site as well is a great place to go if you're looking for arguments on Christianity. I know, Bill, that you sort of do a kind of a podcast as well, don't you?
Yes.
Tell us the details for that.
Well, folks who would like to be a part of our Defenders class that I teach every week can get and listen to the weekly podcast, and it is a training series in Christian doctrine and apologetics. And anyone who can download it and listen to it, I think, will feel very much a part of the class that I teach every week. And so we welcome listeners to download that.
Well, I know that many people will be listening to this as the podcast. So if you listen to Unbelievable as a podcast, you're more than likely to enjoy the Defenders class from Bill's website, reasonablefaith.org. And again, do check out the book as well, Reasonable Faith, now in its third edition. And it's available through the Premier shop, premier.org.uk/shop. Bill, thank you so much for being my guest on the program today.
My pleasure.
God bless you, and take our love with you wherever you are in the States.
Thanks very much, Justin. Bye.
You're unbelievable.
Thanks so much for being part of this program. And don't forget, you can listen again at the webpage premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Please tell your friends about it. That's the only way that we're going to get out there and become a resource for Christians wherever they are. Next week, Alvin Plantinga is our third Master of American Apologetics. He is a contemporary American philosopher, well known in philosophical circles, and really one of the best Christian philosophers out there at the moment, particularly on the problem of evil. How can an all good, all powerful God allow evil in the world? Alvin thinks he has some answers. We're going to be learning from him at the same time next week. Dave and B are here next. Thank you for being with me here on Unbelievable.